This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. With Election Day less than a month away, the race for the White House isn't the only political contest heating up. 34 Senate seats are up for grabs this November 2nd as Democrats and Republicans scramble to secure control of the powerful U.S. legislative body. Control of the Senate means power over Supreme Court nominations, the legislative agenda, even when an impeachment hearing should be called. The Republicans currently enjoy a one-seat majority, but with at least 8 seats up for grabs in hotly contested states, Democrats are hoping to gain some ground and regain control in the ongoing battle for the U.S. Senate. Later in the program, how September 11th is reshaping Webster's Dictionary, but first, a look at interesting Senate races across the country, with a focus on the heated battles in South Dakota and Florida. As always, we want to hear from you. How are U.S. Senate races shaping up in your state? What's at stake? We particularly want to hear from our listeners in South Dakota. What are your views of the heated battle between Senator Tom Daschle and former Representative John Thune? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And here to give us an overview of key U.S. Senate races is NPR's political correspondent, no, sorry, take that, political editor, Ken Rudin. He joins us in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Which job do I get more money for?
The one you got.
Just okay, thanks.
Okay. 34 seats, that's a third, right? Every year a third
that's
turns
correct.
Over. So 34 seats on the ballot. But I suppose, just like the House of Representatives, some of these are not really competitive. So let's start first with some of the incumbents who aren't going to have to worry too much.
Well, I mean, like Barbara Boxer in California, Chuck Schumer in New York. Some of the guys who have been around there for a long time really have nothing to worry about. But again, given the fact that the Republicans have a one-seat majority, there are 5, 6, 7, 8 seats that can go either way. And thus, the Democrats do have a shot at recapturing control that they lost.
So what's causing the competitive seats? Is it, you know, incumbents weakening, or is it people retiring and leaving open seats?
Well, that's certainly true about the Democratic worries. 5 Democratic incumbents in the South: Fritz Hollings in South Carolina, Bob Graham in Florida, John Edwards in North Carolina, John Brough in Louisiana, Zell Miller in Georgia, all retiring. This is strong Bush country. This is the strongest area in the country for the president. And whether they're coattails or not, Republicans are thought to do the strongest in those 5 states in the South.
So let's talk a little bit about North Carolina, where were people surprised that John Edwards decided to give up his seat? Is that fairly typical, or give up the run for his seat?
Well, it was one of the rare times where he was running for president and for re-election in the Senate at the same time. And most people felt that having barely won election in 1998, Edwards would have been a tough fight to recapture, regain his seat, be reelected in this year. So he gave it up to focus on the presidency. Of course, he's now running for vice president.
Right. But and so who are in the race there?
Well, the Democrat is Erskine Bowles, the former chief of staff to Bill Clinton. Erskine Bowles ran for the Senate 2 years ago. It's kind of like a stiff wooden figure, lost to Elizabeth Dole, who, of course, is a well-known figure in the state. But this year, there's a new Erskine Bowles. He's more energized. He's a much more relaxed campaigner. And he's running against a congressman named Richard Burr. Richard Burr is a conservative Republican, very popular in his own district, but again, not known statewide. I should tell you, no Democrat has been elected to the Senate in North Carolina in a presidential year since 1968, which is bad for Bowles. And again, one would think that President Bush will carry North Carolina, but Bowles is running a much better campaign than he ran 2 years ago.
And what about their neighbor to the south, South Carolina?
A much more Republican state, and perhaps much more likely to go Republican, even though Inez Tenenbaum, the Secretary of Education, the Secretary of Education of Schools in South Carolina, elected twice statewide, a popular figure, but it looks like it's a Republican seat. This is the one that Fritz Hollings is giving up. Jim DeMint is a Republican conservative congressman, favored to win this seat, but he got himself in a little hot trouble the other day when he said that we should perhaps replace income tax. No, replace the increase the sales tax at the expense of the income tax. And a lot of people jumped on that remark. But I think Republicans take that seat.
What I'm just curious. They talk about all politics being local, and so certainly some people say they don't like the way the country's going, but they love their representative. Did that happen in Senate races too? Are people devoted to their senator the same way some local districts are devoted to their congressman?
No, congressmen. The re-election rate of members of Congress has always been like 98%. Even in bad years, it's like 95-96%. But that's not the case in the Senate. And again, with the open seats, you have three Republicans retiring as well: Oklahoma, Colorado, and Illinois. Those are three states where Democrats are hoping to pick up. With those eight incumbents not seeking re-election in those eight states, that's where you see most of the turnover.
Okay, let's talk about Louisiana. Now, Louisiana always likes to do things a little differently. So what's the story there?
Louisiana is a kind of state where all candidates run on the same ballot, on the same line. In other words, it's not a Democratic primary or a Republican primary. Several candidates are running on November 2nd. That's when they're having their primary in Louisiana. David Vitter is a New Orleans suburban congressman. He will be the Republican making it into the runoff. There are three Democrats also on the ballot. Chris John is a conservative congressman. John Kennedy is a state treasurer. Republicans have never won a Senate seat in Louisiana, at least not since Reconstruction, since the popular elected senators have been popularly elected. Republicans have never won in Louisiana. Republicans are optimistic this year, but again, there are John Breaux, the retiring Democrat, is working very hard for Chris John. Whatever Democrat comes out of the November 2nd primary will go into a December runoff, and many Democrats feel that given the historical nature of the state, Democrats will hold on to that seat.
So it could be, depending on the outcome, that we don't know who won the Senate until December.
That's right. That's exactly what the fear was 2 years ago, when Mary Landrieu won a very, very close race and had to go to a runoff. Democrats and Republicans are watching that seat. Again, it could be a 50-50 Senate, depending on what happens in Louisiana on November 2nd.
Although from 4 years ago, we know that if it's a 50-50 Senate, we still may not know who's going to be in control of the Senate until we see who wins the presidential election.
That's
if that
right.
Should happen.
And
go ahead.
Exactly. And that's why if George Bush is reelected, Democrats need to pick up two Senate seats. If Kerry wins, then it's only one Senate seat, because then it would be 50-50 with Vice President Edwards breaking the tie.
That's a little complicated, Ken. How do you keep all this straight?
Ask me my wife's name.
I have
no idea.
I know. Yeah. All right. Let's look at a couple of the Republican vacancies up for grabs. What about Illinois? Very dynamic Democrat gets into the race, then a long-term Republican, fighter. But now, what's the status there?
Well, this is the clear seat that the Democrats look likely to pick up. And what's amazing is that it's an African-American candidate. And the reason I say it's amazing is because in the past, black candidates have had a very tough struggle to get elected to the Senate. Only three have been elected since Reconstruction. But Barack Obama won an overwhelming victory in the March primary, very impressive. And the Republicans have basically self-destructed. Peter Fitzgerald retiring. The Republican who won the primary, Jack Ryan, was forced out because of a sex scandal. Now the Republicans had to go to Maryland to get Alan Keyes, another African-American candidate, to run for the Senate. Barack Obama had a 20-point lead even before Keyes got into the race. This looks like a clear pickup for the Democrats.
So, but Alan Keyes just, no traction at all? He came in and no closing the race at all?
Oh, no, not at all. Matter of fact, he spent half his campaign making very controversial statements. He criticized Dick Cheney's gay daughter, and it's a very kind of odd remark, and a lot of Republicans have been distancing themselves from Alan Keyes.
Hmm. Okay, what about Colorado? There, I like that there's a familiar brewing name involved in that. So we can say the battle is brewing, yes?
Yeah, that's right. Or the Republicans are ailing, one or the other.
But
Pete Coors is the Coors Brewery family. Some Democrats say that he's not up enough on the issues. They're calling him Coors Light. But he is a good campaigner. He's a moderate Republican. He beat a very strong conservative in the primary, and the party is clearly behind him. The Democrat in that race is Ken Salazar, the state attorney general, elected two times statewide, so he's well-known among voters. He's also Hispanic, and there's a large increase in Latino voters in Colorado. Very, very close race. Democrats are pretty comfortable about this when they feel like they have a momentum going Salazar's way. But again, Republicans expect a lot of money going for the Coors campaign in these next 4 weeks.
Which of the, do you know? Do we know yet which is going to be the most expensive Senate campaign?
Well, I mean, they're spending, obviously, there are so many millions and millions of dollars.
I just wondered if there was one that had, you know, sometimes there's one that just rockets away with this, usually New York or California.
Well,
exactly. Or
something.
I
mean,
that.
We always think of the famous Dianne Feinstein, Michael Huffington, when millions and millions and millions of dollars. But most of these tough races, like South Dakota, like Colorado, like Oklahoma, these are not major market, like Alaska, these are not major market states. Maybe the most expensive may be Florida, given the fact that there are so many voters there and the race is so close.
Okay, we'll be talking about Alaska before too very long, and Florida, and some of the others. Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or send us an email, nprtalk@npr.org, and tell us what you're making of all this senatorial fighting and inroads, and maybe you have a perspective on the way the campaigns are being waged, or what's most important in a center. You know, that's supposed to be the more deliberative, thoughtful body, and maybe people are turned off. Like this this Oklahoma race has got people, that's got some pretty interesting characters in it. What about that? We heard from the open of the show, Dr. Tom Coburn, who was in the House of Representatives for a while, and he's run into some political problems of his own for some of his work as a doctor.
Right. He sterilized a 20-year-old woman without written permission years ago. He says he did have permission, but again, he has been put on the defensive in a very conservative state that President Bush is likely to win by at least 20 points on November 2nd. Should be good for the Republicans. Don Nichols is giving up the seat after three terms. Coburn was popular when he was a congressman, but again, he's very controversial. He said he's called for the death penalty for doctors who perform abortions. I would think that's not a majority popular position. And he's running against a conservative Democrat, Brad Carson, a member of Congress, a Native American, the Senate's only Native American member of the Senate if he wins.
What happened to Ben Nighthorse?
He is retiring in Colorado.
Yes. Okay, he'll take. I see.
That's
okay,
right.
All right, I got it.
But again, the Republicans should win that seat, but Coburn is keeps getting putting his foot in his mouth more and more, and Democrats are more and more optimistic. Right now, the polls look about dead even.
So I'm not sure how many we've covered so far, but which way do you see? It sounds like you've been saying on several occasions that what looked at first like an easy Republican walk to victory in many of these races is now a lot tighter.
Well, a lot of the Democrats are certainly more optimistic than they were a year ago. Certainly the situation in Colorado with Ben Nighthorse Campbell retiring has given the Democrats a boost with Salazar. They're more optimistic in Oklahoma than they were before. If they could pick up one more, perhaps in Alaska, Elisa Murkowski, who was appointed by her father to the Senate, so she's in a tough race against the former governor, Tony Knowles. Democrats have not won an Alaska Senate race since 1974. Again, a big Bush Republican state, but the nepotism issue is hurting her in Alaska.
Hmm. Well, we'll be getting to that. What happens? I'm just curious now. John Kerry, senator from Massachusetts, he's not up for re-election in Massachusetts.
That's correct.
If he wins the presidency, presumably he retires. What happens if...
Well,
what happens if he loses?
Until recently, what happened with the governor, the Republican governor in this case, Mitt Romney, would have appointed his successor. But the overwhelming Democratic state legislature in Massachusetts changed the rule. They got rid of Romney's involvement in it. If Kerry wins on November 2nd, there will be a special election in Massachusetts to fill the seat that Kerry would vacate.
I see. So it's not a lock, even if Kerry, I mean, there must have been scenarios that if Kerry won and there was a Republican governor and then this Republicans could still retain control of the Senate by appointing, but now that's gone.
That's right. But every Democrat in the state of Massachusetts will be running for that Senate seat, so who knows what could happen there.
All right. We're talking about key U.S. Senate races, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is TOTN@npr.org. We're talking now with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. When we come back, we'll be hearing from some reporters and editors in different parts of the country. So stay with us. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about heated Senate races across the country with NPR's political editor, Ken Rudin. Ken will also be taking your questions next Wednesday, October 13th, in the first of four live online election web chats. More information will be available at npr.org in coming days. Meantime, you can check out NPR's political coverage and Ken's political junkie column today at npr.org. We move now to take a look at the Senate race in South Dakota. If you're from South Dakota, give us a call and tell us how you think the race is shaping up. And in a moment, the battle in Florida. We invite Floridians to join our conversation and tell us why this race is important. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. In South Dakota, Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle is fighting for his seat against former Representative John Thune. Joining us now to give us the latest in this matchup is Bill Harlan, a reporter for the Rapid City Journal in South Dakota. He joins us by phone from his office at the paper. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Joe.
So first, let's get a sense of who these two candidates are. I guess we mostly are familiar with Tom Daschle for his role on the national scene, but how is he viewed in South Dakota?
Well, he's been around for a long time. He started out as an aide to Senator Jim Abaresque way back in the 70s. He won a really tight race for Congress in 1978 against a former POW, and he's been in Congress ever since. So he's an icon here, but his opponent's very well known too.
Well, tell us a little bit about John Thune.
John Thune also started out as a congressional aide to Senator Jim Abner, who Daschle defeated in 1986. John is equally well known. He's held a number of positions inside the state, and he's scored some really impressive victories to win three terms in Congress, landslide victories. And everybody knows who these guys are.
Really? So it's a small state. I mean, I presume that there's a lot of baby kissing and handshaking. Have both candidates been at it full time for a while?
These guys have been at that kind of thing for 20 years here.
You think there's a hand that hasn't been shook or a baby not kissed in the state?
I doubt it. I think there's a lot of people in this state who still remember John Thune's jump shot from high school. And I was on a public radio program one time, and there was an audience full of people in Rapid City, and just as a poll, I said, everybody who's met Tom Daschle personally, clap your hands, and more than half the audience clapped. So there's a lot of people here who know these guys personally.
So if you're well-known and your positions are well-known and your personality is well-known, what do you run on?
Well, that's a good question. I think Tom Daschle runs on his rise to power. If you go on to the New York Times or the Washington Post or even the Washington Times website and do a search for the keyword South Dakota, chances are most of the articles you find will have Tom Daschle's name in them. If you're John Thune, you run against big government. You try to tie Tom Daschle to the liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
I see. And what about John Thune? Obviously, he's got the slight advantage, I should think, that he's not got to be in Washington as much of his time, so he can spend more time pressing the flesh if that's still needed.
Well, that's an advantage and a disadvantage. It's certainly an advantage to, it has been at least an advantage to be a friend of a Republican president. Because this state is going to overwhelmingly vote for George Bush on November 2nd. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. But also it's interesting that the president has not made a single trip here since the conventions to campaign for John Thune, and he made a bunch of them in John Thune's last Senate race, which he lost by the narrowest of margins to Democrat Tim Johnson. So there's the president has some liabilities here, too.
Okay. Ken Rudin, did you want to put a question to Bill Harlan?
Yeah, Bill, I'm just going to ask, what kind of balancing act does Daschle have to do? Because obviously in Washington he's seen as perhaps an obstructionist. That's what the Republicans call him, an obstructionist leading the Democrats opposed to President Bush, whereas in South Dakota he's running ads praising President Bush.
Well, you know, I think it's you shouldn't overstate the ads praising President Bush. You know, he had one controversial ad on which showed him hugging the president after the president's very dramatic and effective speech after 9/11. But latest round of Daschle ads is pointing out the fact that 2 years ago when South Dakota was seeking drought aid, President Bush said no, and John Thune, at least publicly, didn't hammer the president on that. So I think that when you get down to specific issues, you got to remember that South Dakota is a state that receives a lot more federal aid than it sends back to Washington.
Why don't we take a call? Let's go to Wally in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Wally, welcome to the program.
Oh, good afternoon, good afternoon.
Yep.
I was just calling to say that as a native South Dakotan, or I grew up in South Dakota, actually, I really thought it was our senator's responsibility to be the state people to watch out for the world, the nation and the world, and our, you know, as McGovern did, and our representatives to represent the people. I don't understand why Daschle gets bashed because he doesn't come back to South Dakota often enough.
That's interesting. Is that indeed happening, Bill Harlan?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
that. Well, the question was, is Senator Daschle, getting criticized in South Dakota for being a Washingtonian and not coming back to the state enough, and why the state member of Congress is the one who should be coming back and staying in touch with the people, and the senators are supposed to think deep thoughts and represent their districts, represent their states more broadly.
Yeah, the question confuses me a little bit. Are you saying that a senator should not come back to South Dakota?
Well, I think the caller was suggesting that might be the case, but
I think George McGovern lost in 1980 because he didn't come back to South Dakota as a senator. He was kind of branded as the Beltway or Hollywood Democrat, and Daschle, for good or ill, has made a point of visiting all 66 counties every single year. So he spends a lot of time in the state. Now, whether a senator should or should not do that,
We'll leave that one up in the air. One more quick call. Mark in Kyle, South Dakota. Welcome to the program.
Yes,
Kyle.
How are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Great. What's your question? Where are you calling from, first of all?
Kyle, on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Right, okay. And so what's your question?
I don't have a question, just a comment that the Republican legislature in South Dakota took it upon themselves a year ago to pass a rule that every voter has to produce a photograph ID, and on the reservation, that was never commonly how things are done because virtually everybody knows everybody else at the polling places. And I think rightly so, Indian residents of the state have seen this as an attack by the Republicans, and I think what's going to happen with that is a backlash vote. It's going to make it very difficult for Republicans to get any kind of a meaningful vote in Indian country. And that could be the difference this year in terms of if Daschle was in any danger, he's probably in less danger because of that move on the part of the Republican state legislature.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much. Do you agree with that, Bill Harlan?
Well, that was controversial here, and there were some errors in some counties, and some of them were reservation counties. The actual law says you have to have photo ID. But if you don't have a photo ID, you can also sign an affidavit. And that was not made clear at some polling places. And there were bad feelings about it. And the vote on South Dakota's reservations, I do think it will be critical. It was pretty important in 2002. And it's very difficult to predict because it's somewhat hard to poll on reservations where not everybody has phone.
Okay. Bill Harlan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bill Harlan is a reporter for the Rapid City Journal in South Dakota. He joined us by phone from his office at the paper. And now we turn to the ultimate battleground state, or at least it's become the ultimate battleground state, Florida. Democrat Betty Castor is in a tight race for the open Senate seat against former Housing and Development Secretary Mel Martinez. Joining us now to give us an update on this race is Steve Bosquet, a reporter for the St. Petersburg Times. He joins us by phone from his office in Florida. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So Mel Martinez was basically hand-picked for this race by the Bush administration. Has that been a big factor?
Well, I think it certainly helped him win the nomination. There's no question about it. He's had the advantage of being able to campaign with the likes of in no particular order. Rudy Giuliani has been down here for Mel Martinez a couple of times. Rick Santorum over the weekend. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist was in Tampa with Martinez. And Vice President Cheney is coming down later this week for a visit that was postponed because of one of the hurricanes. So he's getting a lot of help from big-name Republicans all over the country.
And what about Betty Castor? She's not unknown. She's a former state education secretary and also a former president of the University of Florida, if I got that right.
She was president of the University of South Florida.
Florida, yeah, okay.
Well, the same. But, you know, of course, Betty Castor is going to be campaigning in the next couple of weeks with the likes of, among others, Ted Kennedy. She has announced plans to do events with both Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and other Democratic senators. And we have this array of third-party groups, 527s, that have done so much in Florida regarding voter registration and voter mobilization on the Democratic side that she's probably going to benefit from some of that, without a doubt.
Ken Rudin, who's still with me here in the studio, is it clear in Florida that these people coming down from Washington are helping one candidate or the other?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, we were just talking about South Dakota. President Bush is so popular in South Dakota, couldn't put John Thune over the top 2 years ago in South Dakota. It's hard to say what kind of effect these campaigners. I'm mostly interested in what, given the fact that the state has been so ravaged by these hurricanes, how much. Are the voters focusing on this race, or are they just starting to pay attention?
Yeah, well, not yet, Ken, I don't think. And this race is still, first of all, a Senate race in Florida run, you know, on the same cycle as a presidential race, starts out under the radar to begin with. Now you've had four hurricanes, and you've got a situation where these candidates cannot get their message heard. We're probably going to end up having a 2 to 3 week Senate race, probably one of the shortest Senate races in a big state this size ever, and that's going to decide the thing.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, just as it happens, I was in St. Petersburg yesterday, and I flipped on the television, and there was Betty Castor smiling at me and telling how much she was going to do for seniors. So they're clearly starting their media buys.
That's right. You know, the one area, of course, that is still in really rough shape is the Western Panhandle. The area west of Panama City over to the Alabama state line, that area is overwhelmingly Republican. And that is an important area, not only for the president, but also for Mel Martinez. Another aspect of this race that it is extremely important, I think, is Hispanic pride. And it's an issue that Mel Martinez has been emphasizing, but it's the idea that the Martinez campaign thinks they can get even Democrats who are Hispanic to cross over and vote for Mel Martinez. Because he's a symbol of Hispanic pride and patriotism to be the first Cuban American in the United States Senate.
So quickly, do you have a sense of where this race is going, one side, one direction or the other?
I would say this. I mean, the polls and even the candidates themselves have a feeling that the race is either neck and neck or with Castor slightly ahead. At this point, Martinez came out of a really bloody primary. And has sort of been, you know, he's sort of not really on his game yet in the general election. It just doesn't seem like. Then you've had the hurricanes. But I think this race is extremely closely tied to the presidential. And if President Bush carries Florida, and the most recent polls suggest that he was ahead in Florida, that's good news for Martinez.
Okay. Steve Bosquet, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Steve Bosquet is a reporter for the St. Petersburg Times. He joined us by phone from his office in Florida. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ken Rudin is still with me here in Studio 3A, and we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-TALK, and let's take a call from Stephanie in Cleveland, Ohio. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
I must say I'm surprised. I thought Ohio was the ultimate battleground state.
Oh, well, perhaps we got it wrong. You know, that's why we have a letter section. You should write to us and let us know our error. Go ahead with your question.
Well, I am calling regarding Eric Fingerhut, who is running against our incumbent, George Voinovich. I realize we're down a little bit, Senator Fingerhut is, but he's really been, you want to talk about pressing the flesh, and he recently completed a walk across Ohio from Cincinnati all the way up to Cleveland and met more people and all kinds of baby kissing going on. I was wondering, you think Senator Fingerhut's chances are, I call him Senator because he is currently a state senator.
Okay. All right, Stephanie, that's an interesting question, but maybe Ken thinks there, has he got enough time to meet everybody in the state and convince them he's the man?
Well, the problem with Eric Fingerhut is that he's running against a well-established Republican, George Voinovich, the former mayor of Cleveland, former lieutenant governor, former governor, now a senator. Very popular. I mean, the conservatives are not mad about him because he's pretty frank about taxes and the deficit and things like that. It seems like it's going to be a tough year for anybody to beat Voinovich this year. However, there have been a lot of reports of overwhelming new numbers of voters being registered by the Democrats in Ohio, especially in the Cleveland area. The race could be closer than expected, but nobody thinks Voinovich is vulnerable.
Okay, one more call. Let's go to Julie in Anchorage, Alaska. Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to offer what I hope are some insights into the race here in Alaska for United States Senate. I think it's very difficult for people outside of Alaska to understand the depth of feeling among people of different parties here against the Republican senator who's running, Lisa Murkowski, because of the way in which she got her appointment. I'm not a Democrat. And as a professional woman, I've always been inclined to try and vote for female candidates. But many people here in Alaska have been so appalled by the governor appointing his own daughter to the United States Senate that we have gotten an initiative put on the ballot to remove the authority of the governor to ever do such a thing again. And right now, many people in Alaska feel that Tony Knowles, the Democrat nominee, is going to be winning. Because even though Alaska is a predominantly Republican state, Republicans outnumber Democrats 2-1, there is a large percentage of Alaskans who are independent or nonpartisan. And Governor Knowles was elected governor of Alaska twice, even though he's a Democrat in a Republican state. And the depth of feeling against the current governor, Murkowski, and his daughter, because of the way in which she got her appointment, is really intense here.
Okay, Julie, let me get Ken Rudin's thoughts on that. Thanks for the call.
I think Julie's exactly right. I mean, Lisa Murkowski is not a bad campaigner. She's not a bad senator. But again, the anger towards the way she was appointed by her father had been senator, elected governor in 2002, and then turned around and appointed his own daughter. Plus the fact that Lisa Murkowski, a week or two ago, held a press conference at an Exxon station now in Alaska. Now, if anybody remembers the Valdez, Exxon is not the kind of place you'd want to have a campaign stop. But again, Tony Knowles, a Democrat, popular, Lisa Murkowski is going to have a tough time winning the election.
Strange. Well, interesting too. Okay, when we come, thanks very much, Ken.
Thanks.
When we come back from a short break, new additions to the Encarta's Webster's Dictionary of the English Language. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.